Ukraine taunts its invaders over a blown-up bridge. Today, Russia retaliates. It's Monday, October 10th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today is Indigenous Peoples Day, or Columbus Day, depending on where you live. And we've got a few conversations for the occasion, including a chat with author Louise Erdrich and a look at how wearable robots are helping preserve native languages. But first, missiles rained down on cities across Ukraine today. Ukrainian officials say the entire country is under attack from Russian missiles and drones, just days after an explosion knocked out a strategic bridge linking Russia with Crimea. Isabel Kershudian is Ukraine bureau chief for our editorial partners at The Washington Post. She spoke with Robin Young this morning from a city east of Kyiv, which suffered some of the worst shelling it's seen in months over the weekend.
We're going to start now with the news in Ukraine, which early today faced some of the worst Russian shelling since the start of the war. 84 missiles, 10 cities. Retaliation for the attack Saturday on that key bridge that connected Russia to annexed Crimea. Just a few hours ago, Russia's President Vladimir Putin gave a speech threatening more Russian missile strikes. The EU condemned the Russian attacks and warned Belarus to back off allowing Russia to fire missiles across its border. Isabel Kershudian is the Ukraine bureau chief for our editorial partners at The Washington Post. She's in Kryvyi Rih, east of Kyiv. Isabel, what are you seeing and hearing?
Yeah, I mean, where I'm at, which is ironically much closer to the front line than Kyiv is, not too bad here today. I mean, pretty much every city in Ukraine experienced some sort of missile strike, you know, strikes to power plants, things that would disrupt, you know, light, power, electricity, water. So, you know, here there's obviously a sense of nervousness around people who are just kind of waiting for what's next. I think a lot of people are just, you know, staying inside today, sheltering in place. But really the main kind of attacks today were in the capital itself and really in the downtown area, which is something we haven't really seen for the entire war. Even when the Russian troops were right outside of Kyiv, they never managed to strike the city center itself until today.
Well, and you say there's been critical infrastructure struck elsewhere in the country, but we know, for instance, one missile fell right near a playground in Kyiv.
Yeah, that's a very popular park. It's actually only a couple blocks away from my apartment there. You know, I remember walking around last weekend and it was filled with families, people riding bikes, people just sitting on a bench. I mean, it's really the heart of the city, right next to, you know, the National University, is really busy around that time of morning, you know, 8:30, where, you know, you've obviously got rush hour traffic and it's a main kind of road. So, you know, most of the casualties have been just people who are probably going to work and were in their cars.
Well, and you say there's some nervousness. Was there also an expectation that after the attack on the bridge that was so important to Russia, it linked Crimea, which Russia has annexed, to the Russian mainland? Ukrainian officials haven't claimed credit for that attack, but we're seeing pictures of Ukrainians posing in front of, you know, photographs of the blown up bridge. Was there an expectation that Russia would respond?
Yes, I think so. But, you know, the soldiers I was with here at the southern front line, even a couple days ago on Saturday, right after the explosion at the bridge happened, I mean, they were among those who were pretty stoked about it. But even they were kind of on edge waiting for the bombardment that was going to come after that. I think people definitely expected some kind of an answer. But then to, you know, see it happen, especially downtown Kyiv, where I think a lot of people had assumed that the air defense there was the strongest in the country.
Yeah. Well, look, many Russians have been expressing themselves with their feet, leaving Russia to avoid the draft to fight in Ukraine. But we also know there's a hawk element in Russia that's been criticizing Putin for the way the war is going. And on Saturday, a new general was appointed, Sergei Surovikin. He previously led Russian forces in Syria. He's been accused of using brutal and controversial military tactics there in Syria. Can we assume that this escalation is in part Putin trying to demonstrate to hawks in his country that he's got a handle on this war?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, propagandists in Russia are rejoicing over this. You've got Ramzan Kadyrov, you know, the head of the Chechen Republic saying that he's finally 100% satisfied with the direction that this is going. The proxy leader of Crimea also saying that there's been a good change and, you know, this is good news today. So I think Putin, you know, as much as anything, needed to demonstrate, you know, to his own kind of circle and the pressure he was facing for kind of battlefield failures that, hey, we're still to be feared here.
And what's been the Ukrainian response to these missile strikes? We know Putin has accused the Ukrainians of being terrorists. Today, Ukrainian President Zelensky said that these were terrorist attacks on his country. How else is he responding?
Yeah, I think the Ukrainian response now is to really show this to the world and say, this is why we need better air defense systems. This is something they've been asking for, tranches of security assistance for a while now. And I think they're going to say, look, we told you that we needed this, and this is why. You know, Zelensky, what he did was go outside of his office, very similar to the first days of the war, where he kind of films a selfie video of himself in downtown Kyiv and kind of reassure Ukrainians that, you know, Ukraine existed before this and it will exist after this, and, you know, tell people to stay inside and shelter today.
That's the Washington Post Ukraine Bureau Chief Isabel Krasudian in country talking about today's missile strikes from Russia. Isabel, thank you, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Coming up...
Bow, hello. Let's learn Taíno together.
Robots that ride on your shoulder and speak indigenous languages. It's a reality thanks to a young inventor in San Diego. That's after the break. We've got some big news at Here and Now today. Our radio show has a new co-host. Deepa Fernandez comes to us from the Bay Area, where she was the San Francisco Chronicle's immigration correspondent. Today's her first full day on air for us, and there's a lot more to her story that you can read about on our website. So if you want to learn more about Deepa or any of the fine people who make this show, head over to hereandnow.org and click on Meet the Staff. But today I really wanted to share this story Deepa did with producer Ashley Locke. It's about a 21-year-old Ojibwe woman named Danielle Boyer. When she was just 10 years old, Danielle realized kids in her community weren't being taught their own culture and history. So she asked her mom if she could teach a class to kindergartners. Soon, she discovered a passion for science and robotics, and now she's doing something pretty remarkable. She builds wearable robots that help teach native languages. Danielle Boyer is the founder of the nonprofit The STEAM Connection, and here's her conversation with our new host, Deepa Fernandez.
Anine, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Danielle, why robots? And what do you see as their potential for your community?
Robots are so powerful. They can teach us so many tech skills, everything from electrical engineering to mechanical engineering to computer science. They teach problem solving, team building, and can even prevent developmental delays. I see it as an all-encompassing tool that kind of gives us back a lot of power.
How did you learn how to make robots and do it affordably? Because I'm imagining making a robot is not cheap.
Making robots definitely is not cheap, and learning about them is even less accessible. I was interested in robots after seeing that my sister was. I joined a robotics team and I was super excited, especially because it was kind of expensive to participate. But I actually got bullied the whole time. I did not fit in, and it was clear that the other students didn't really want me to be there. I ended up leaving and joining another team, and the same thing happened again. I was one of the only girls. And I created my organization because every student deserves to have a safe space to learn and to be themselves. And that's why I'm doing the work that I do now.
Sounds like you've persevered through a lot.
It's honestly nothing that my students haven't been through as well, which is why I think that this work is so important.
So I want you to do some show and tell, because I think that'll really help all of us to see or to hear what exactly you're talking about. So you have some wearable robots right there, right?
Yes, I do. I have one on my shoulder right now.
Ooh, so can you introduce us?
This one is going to be speaking the Taíno language.
Bow, hello. Let's learn Taíno together. My name is Priscilla Colon. I helped to create Casa Areito, and I'm a Taíno teacher. I am Boricua, a Taíno from Boriquén, the island of Puerto Rico. Let's get to know one another. In Taíno, Haralu Buk Anulia means, what is your name? Say it with me. Haralu Buk Anulia. To answer, you say, Dak Anulia, and then say your name. Try it with me. Dak Anulia.
This is super cool. So I imagine then this robot, like how big is it? Kind of the size of your hand?
It's a little bit bigger than my hand. It's enough that it can sit on your shoulder and it's like half the size of your head.
Okay. So you've kind of got a buddy right there on your shoulder. What does it look like?
It looks a lot like a minion. That was totally unintentional. But the goal of the robot is to be customizable by students, to be able to have different elements from our cultures and communities. So for me, I have Ojibwe woodland florals all over the robot. So a lot of flowers and things that represent my community. And the kids can add different things like ribbon skirts and hats and beaded elements and earrings and things.
Hmm. You know, I wonder, it sounds like you have a few different goals here when it comes to what you're trying to achieve. And I wonder if Native children learning and reclaiming history is a big one, or is it more that you want young people to see that, young Native people to see that they have a future in science and technology?
My biggest goal is to equip my students with the skills to be able to build better things for our communities. Whether that looks like robots or it looks like something else, I think every kid should have tech skills in this day and age.
Can you maybe end with a story or an anecdote or something that comes to mind of one of your students grabbing one of these robots and what it inspired in them?
I think the biggest example is when I remember one of my students came up to me and said, "You're the first Native person I've ever seen in robotics, and that makes me want to do it too." And that really made me emotional and inspired to see the power that us being ourselves has and being authentic to ourselves, to our community. I just think that's such a beautiful thing.
Danielle Boyer is an inventor, educator, and activist. She's with Ojibwe from the Sault Ste. Marie tribe. Danielle, thank you so much.
Miigwech, thank you for having me.
Deepa also spoke with Ruth Buffalo, a state representative who was instrumental in replacing Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day in Fargo, North Dakota. You can hear that one at hereandnow.org. Coming up, Robin Young speaks with author Louise Erdrich about her latest novel, The Sentence. That's after the break.
Louise Erdrich is a member of the Turtle Mountain Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning 2020 book, The Night Watchman, tells of her grandfather's attempts to save that tribe in the 1950s when the U.S. government was trying to wipe them out. Her latest novel, The Sentence, tells of a more recent chapter in American history, 2020, the first year of the pandemic. And it's a story of mysticism and sometimes hilarity. It centers on Tuki, who steals a dead body for a friend who's actually setting her up because that body is packed with drugs. Hey, it could happen. After Tuki leaves prison, we land with her in an Indigenous people's bookstore in Minneapolis. It's owned by an author named Louise. Louise Erdrich owns a bookstore in Minneapolis. But as we're processing that, our Tuki is off on a wild ride, haunted by a ghost. Then there's the ghostly steam from the hospital. Is that the spirit of dying COVID patients? And George Floyd's spirit hovers over all. This is Minneapolis in 2020. Again, the book is The Sentence. It's now out in paperback. We spoke with Louise Erdrich when it first came out in November.
The first line came: while in prison, I received a dictionary. Everything unspools from that sentence. I always knew I wanted to write a book about a haunted bookstore. And this is the only bookstore I really know about. I wrote that sentence down, and I had to get her to the bookstore because I knew she had to be haunted. Mm-hmm. And in prison, one is not allowed to have all sorts of other things that distract human beings, you know, cell phones and Netflix and anything but books, really. You know, there's movies or some TV, but, you know, mainly people do a lot of reading. And so that became her reason for looking for a bookstore job afterward. You know, things, one sentence contains so much if you have to follow everything in it down to its source, right?
Well, and that sentence, as you say, launches the book. Elsewhere in the book, we don't want to give too much away, she has to find the perfect sentence to unlock a mystery. She served a sentence. Yeah.
But also, not to give too much away, but it happens right in the beginning, too. A sentence may have killed someone.
A sentence in a book may have killed someone.
So there's all sorts of things having to do with sentences.
Well, and all sorts of things haunting. She is haunted by that body that she took for a friend. She's haunted by a real-life ghost. This is a frequent customer who's kind of a pain in the neck. She's a white customer named Flora, who in life, if I've got this right, was a Native American wannabe.
Right.
Who doesn't want to have their culture embraced, except there's a difference between embracing and this kind of wannabe-ness. I mean, on page 77, you have a list of questions that Tookie gets in the bookstore. Can you direct me to the nearest ayahuasca ritual? How do I register to be an Indian? How much Indian are you? I want to give my dog an Indian name. Can you tell me one? How do I get an Indian name? A lot of eye-rolling.
Right. Well, these were also questions I have been asked throughout my life as a writer, just in book signings. And people are very curious about Indigenous people in the United States or all over the world, I'm sure. But I feel that these are not the questions of people who are enemies. These are people who don't understand. And it's very hard to understand because there's so many, there's a 576 at last count, federally recognized tribes. And we're all so very different. So it's a lot to encompass.
Well, and as you say, not the enemy, but some more blissfully ignorant than others. I mean, in the book, there's a character who cheerfully comes in talking about, you know, she has a cottage on a lake. The land belonged at one time to Native Americans, and she talks about the skeletons that her great aunt dug up and won a blue ribbon at a science fair. And here, maybe you know what to do with them. And this is just an out, you know, it's just a spiritual outrage happening in front of Tookie and a friend. And the friend, the coworker, is saying, like, yeah, but are you going to give back the land? That cuts a little deeper.
It does. And there's a huge issue with human remains that are still held by, you know, small-town museums, historical societies, private residences, all sorts of things. And, you know, one of the things that is notable about the book is that it's not the white people who are being haunted. It's the Native people who are being haunted by white people. So these things are very common. And our numbers as Native people in the United States are so small, it's very hard to get a larger conversation going.
And then there's so many storylines here, but then there's the thread of COVID in Minneapolis, the protests after the George Floyd murder. This was born of the year.
Well, it was, but as I said, I wanted to write this book about a haunted bookstore. And I started it in 2014. I looked back, and it was quite a while ago. I was writing it. I would always start it on All Souls Day when the fabric between the worlds is at its thinnest. So I would come back to that every year and maybe think of a little more, take more notes. Finally, in 2019, I decided I'm going to start on this All Souls Day, and I will not quit. I will write it until All Souls Day 2020, Well, it took longer than that. I couldn't write during all of the things that happened. I had no focus. My daughter, Pallas, took a lot of notes, and she helped me put things into a time frame because I'm not good at that, and I'm not a reporter. I'm not a journalist. So I put things into sequence and allowed my characters to go through the experience of each thing that happened. They're not true to what I experienced. It was the only thing I could think of to do because that's what I am. I'm a fiction writer. So, but things were set up from the beginning because from the beginning I had Tookie being arrested by someone she cares about. That sets up a very complex dynamic by spring 2020.
Right. When everyone in the world, but from your city, is watching George Floyd.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Books are certainly a salvation for Tookie as she's dealing with COVID and suddenly trying to mail books to people or send books or drop off books to people because the bookstore is closed, and the pain and the passion in the streets from, you know, after the murder of George Floyd and a ghost. And you, she, talks about books throughout. She's reading Cool for You by Eileen Miles, just thrown into one scene. To a customer who likes the mystery writer Louise Penny, she gushes over Donna Leone. In the back of the book, the totally biased list of Tookie's favorite books. Tookie can't live without you, so those are yours. Tell me what the role books play here.
Actually, I tried to make it so perhaps she has some books that I wouldn't have thought about. But my favorite was her ghost managing book list. So she has to try and manage the ghost during the pandemic. You know, we're trying to have the safest workspace possible for everyone who was in the bookstore. So we had people working alone because we're tiny. That set up a sense for me of being haunted, just being alone with all these books containing so many different consciousnesses. It is haunting in itself. So many things became haunting.
Yeah, because
in 2020 and 21, you know.
Yeah, all the voices in the books, they're all there.
All the voices, yes.
Well, the ghost managing book list includes The Uninvited Guests by Sadie Jones, The Underground Railroad.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. One of my favorites on it is Devin Hsu's The Hatuk Witches. It's a compelling read. I enjoyed the ghost managing book list as I went through it. I read through as much as I could.
The other thing that happens in your books is there's a casual use of Native American language. And there were a couple of moments where I thought, oh, gee, I'd love to ask about that. And if you don't mind, there was a quote, and it referred to NDN.
Oh, NDN, that's Billy Ray Belcourt's book, NDN Coping Mechanisms, and other. I think it's Other Notes from the Field. Oh, I love that book. You know, you say it, Indian. So it's a joke. It's an in-joke for people.
I read somewhere that Indian, could also stand for not dead native in reference to the Civil War general who said the only good Indian.
It was also Teddy Roosevelt, and it was also Frank Baum who wrote The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
So it's not just one person.
It is amazing, Louise Erdrich, that you and your characters do have such a sense of humor.
Well, my characters and I would say most Indigenous people, that's the only generalization I can make. The people are funny. You know, my daughter and I went to Dune the other day, and the Fremen have been compared to and are the Indigenous people of the planet. So we were waiting for some really good jokes, but they didn't come. So I'm hoping in the next do, and I'm putting it out there, would you please make the Fremen crack a few jokes?
Pulitzer and National Book Award winner Louise Erdrich. Her new novel is The Sentence. You'll just chew on it. Louise, thank you.
thank you so much. Thank you, Robin. It's just been a pleasure to talk to you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. As always, there's a lot more from our radio show. Our Florida-based editor, Kat Welch, went to the coast, where power is back on and some people are trying to rebuild after Hurricane Ian.
All you're seeing is piles of metal, and nobody has moved anything. This is what the wind did. This is where it put it. And it's my roof, their roof, who knows whose roof?
You know where to find that one, hereandnow.org. Today's stories were produced by Thomas Danielian, Ashley Locke, and Emiko Tamagawa. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Theme music by Mike, Max Liebman, and me, Chris Bentley. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the holiday. See you tomorrow.